Blog Talk Radio.
Show is for mature audiences only. That means, boys and girls, you must be 18 years of age or older to listen.
Infidelity is running rampant in our society. Just this week, the governor of South Carolina, Mark Sanford, admitted that he flew off to Argentina to indulge in his impulsive, lustful desires with a woman other than his wife, known simply as Maria. Was this truly surprising in this day and age we live in? Some in American society argue that the idea of a monogamous marriage is becoming more and more a concept whose time has passed. Is it possible to keep the erotic sparks alive in a long-term committed relationship when you see your partner every day of every week of every year, and you know all of their insecurities, quirks, idiosyncrasies, and the strengths and weaknesses of their personality and character? One woman says, yes, it's possible. Her book is entitled Mating in Captivity, Unlocking Erotic Intelligence. And in this highly sought-after collection of priceless words of wisdom for couples, my guest for the evening asserts that sometimes knowing too much about your partner actually diminishes the excitement of your sexual chemistry. That basically, you should be together, but at the same time, a wee bit separate. Who is this woman who has created some degree of controversy by telling her readers, among other things, that it is okay for one partner to hide a one-night stand and or a weekend fling from their loved one? Her name is Miss Esther Perel, and this highly accomplished author and sex therapist is about to enlighten my listening audience about the connection between long-lasting love and very intense erotic excitement as she chooses to get up front and straightforward with Alan Roger Curry.
Oh my God, is this the Alan Roger Curry of Mode 1 fame? Oh my God.
You're really good at this.
Gotta ask you, do you feel that black men have some type of unwritten obligation to date and marry someone in a race? You do?
I think they do. I think white people should date white people. I think black people should date black people.
Now, how did you come up with this idea to go to Italy with the women?
With the women, right. I just got so tired of hearing all my male friends talk about Brazil and how great Brazil is for them.
When I was growing up, I would go and hear about black women complaining about white women are stealing our men. Don't complain about your goods being stolen if you casually leave them on the front porch.
Have sex. Enjoy your life.
You know, men really want women to have standards. They really do. And I don't know how we got off of the mark there, but men do like classy women, and they want women to have standards.
I think you can be single and be very, very happy, and I think it's about taking the pressures off about being married.
I'm not saying that you should disrespect a woman. Never disrespect your woman, but the key is to not let her walk all over you.
Romantic love is very volatile. People don't realize it. And it is a drug. People don't realize it. Men and women do stupid things. Not all men, but sometimes you'll do something stupid.
I think it's a turn-on because just to see that person, just to enjoy themselves and just to watch them touching that person and making them feel good, I think that's kind of sexy, actually.
Yo, yo, mode one. This is Gerard McClendon from Chicago Tonight and the McClendon Report. Right now you're listening to Upfront and Straightforward with my good friend, Alan Roger Curry. Mode one, let the women know, fellas, what you're really thinking. Ha ha, Alan Roger Curry.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of Upfront and Straightforward with Alan Roger Curry. We're on the Blog Talk Radio, Internet Radio Network, and I'm your host, Alan Roger Curry. And today is Thursday, June 25th, and there's been a lot of sad news tonight. I'll get to that in a second. But tonight we're going to go into the erotic zone by having a conversation with a book author and well-respected sex therapist who has been... She's had some interesting ideas expressed about sex within the context of a relationship. But before I get into more detail about that, the next few weeks will be just full of eroticism, sex. Next week I will have Dr. Yvonne K. Fulbright. She's a well-respected sexologist, and she'll join me next week to talk about sex toys for women, orgasmic hotspots for women, and female masturbation. I think it's an understatement to say that's going to be an interesting and provocative conversation. 2 weeks from now, I will have a guest co-host by the name of Frantonia Pollins, and she will be here to discuss Madonna Horror Syndrome Part 2. Part 1 actually was last year with a guest by the name of Stephanie J. Jones, where we talked about men who are afflicted by the Madonna Horror Syndrome. Matter of fact, I'm going to touch on that with my guest tonight. But we're going to have Madonna Horror Syndrome Part 2 next week. And then 2 weeks from now, I'm going to have Dr. Debbie. Dr. Debbie will be here. She's a well-respected sex educator at Indiana University, and we'll be here to talk about the strengths and weaknesses of sex education in the 21st century. Want to give much props to those in my chat room. I got two of my cousins in the chat room. I got Christopher Curry, alias Hype Style. I got Jason P. Jones, alias Southside JJ. Southside JJ in the chat room. I got Dr. Jane Branham, alias Power Path of Love in the chat room. I got Shonda, alias Virtual for Me in the chat room. I got my good loyal friend, Adrian, in the chat room as
Diva 362636, and the lovely and sexy Angel Eyes is in the chat room supporting me, and I'm sure I'll have some others sneaking in to the chat room a little bit later. Some other shout outs would be my brother and Ace Confidant, Stephen Curry. Both of us are somewhat distraught this evening about the news of Michael Jackson passing. We were extremely big fans of Michael Jackson. I'll touch on that in a second, but yeah, me and my brother. But some more shout outs would be a number of people who support my show, such as Harold Leonard, David Ferguson, support my show, Kimberly Brown, support my show, Miriam Jacobs, Kimberly Rice, Adolphus Nolan, Kimberly Buckley, Toy Rayburn, just a number of people. Some of my colleagues on here, Will Wavy, Kathy Holloway Hill, Steve Dedean Williams, all support my show, and I appreciate it fully. The big news, of course, today is the passing. Well, first we got news that Farrah Fawcett, who was probably one of my favorite angels on Charlie's Angels, she passed away today. So my condolences to her family and her loved ones. I think her along with that show kind of changed pop culture, and she had that infamous poster that was on almost all teenagers' walls. So Farrah Fawcett passed, but more dear to my heart is Michael Jackson. Jackson 5, as long as I can remember, when it comes to entertainment, that's my first, that's my longest memory, is the Jackson 5. Because the Jackson 5, for me, before the Jackson 5 made it big, and I know some women out there didn't think I was this old. I know y'all thought I was about 32, 33. But I thought celebrities were almost like their own race of people. I honestly, and some people might laugh at that, but when I was a youngster, I did not look at celebrities as real people. I looked at them almost like they were born in Hollywood or wherever else. The Jackson 5 is what made success in the entertainment industry and success in general real to me. Because I saw them go from neighborhood legends to worldwide superstars. I remember going to Westside High School in Gary, Indiana, and their mean-looking father came on the stage and said, "Do you want to hear my sons?" And we all said, "Yeah." And he said, "Then shut up." That's really what he said. He was like, "Then shut up." Guess who was the opening act in that concert at Westside High School? The Commodores. They were this unknown group. Nobody even knew who the heck the Commodores were. And they were the Jackson 5's opening act, and they came and performed at Westside. Pretty much 80 to 90% of concerts I've seen in my life were Jackson concerts. I've seen two or three people that was a non-Jackson, but the only concerts I've gone to multiple times was either the Jackson 5, Michael Jackson, or Janet Jackson. So, I'm just really hurt that he has passed away. His legacy, I don't care about all them scandals towards in his life. I defended him to the death. All my friends and relatives know that. You ain't never heard a negative word uttered out of my mouth about Michael Jackson or his family, because they were a talented group. They made my hometown proud. I think, quite arguably, he might go down as the greatest entertainer ever. Of course, that's subjective on my part. I'm sure other people say Elvis and whoever else, Marvin Gaye. I got respect for all the singers who have talent. But my preference or my, subjective leaning in terms of naming the greatest, I would say Michael Jackson, because he got me excited every time I heard him. But anyway, I'm not going. This is not a show. I'm going to talk about Michael Jackson later on in the show. I don't want to put too much emphasis on that now because that's be disrespectful to my guest this evening because we got a lot to talk about as it relates to relationships, eroticism. So what I'm going to do right now is, well, first, I got to play this. I got to play this for everybody knows now about Governor Mark Sanford. And I'll let you just hear this.
So the bottom line is this. I've been unfaithful to my wife. I developed a relationship with a what started as a dear friend from Argentina. It began very innocently, as I suspect many of these things do, in just a casual email back and forth, in advice on one's life there and advice here. But here, recently, over this last year, it developed into something much more than that. And as a consequence, I hurt her. I hurt my wife. I hurt my boys. I hurt a lot of different folks.
Hey, I don't want to make fun of him. At least he was honest about it. That was Governor, South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford, admitting that he went to Argentina, cheating on his wife. Man, some dudes just go across the city, you know, the neighborhood. But he went to Argentina, man. That must have been some really good poonanny for you to go to Argentina. But, hey, man, this is summertime. I'm going to let you enjoy this song while I connect with my guest for the evening, and I'll be right back.
Drum, please. Slightly transformed, just a bit of a break from the norm, just a little something to break the monotony of all that hardcore dance that has gotten to be a little bit out of control. It's cool to dance, but what about a groove that soothes and moves romance? Give me a soft, subtle mix, and if it ain't broke, then don't try to fix it. And think of the summers of the past, adjust the bass and let the alpine blast. Pop in my CD and let me run a rhyme and put your car on cruise and lay back, cause it's summertime. Summertime. Double Dutch.
while the DJ's spinning a tune as the old folks dance at your family reunion. Then 6 o'clock rolls around. You just finished wiping your car down. It's time to cruise, so you go to the summertime hangout. It looks like a car show. Everybody come looking real fine, fresh from the barbershop, a fly from the beauty salon. Every moment frontin' and maxin', chillin' in the car, they spend all day waxin', leanin' to the side, but you can't speed through 2 miles an hour, so everybody sees you. There's an air of love and of happiness, and this is the Fresh Prince's new definition of summer madness.
Now, maybe if Governor Mark Sanford of South Carolina would have talked to my guest for the evening, he would have understood his own needs better and the needs of his soon-to-be ex-wife. I don't want to tease Sanford too much because, again, I appreciate it coming forth right about his extramarital affair. My guest tonight is a licensed marriage and family therapist who has spent half her life treating patients and other half coaching, consulting, and training for organizations and lay and professional audiences, an acknowledged authority on cultural identity, cross-cultural relations, and ethnic and religious intermarriage. My guest for the evening has led private and public interventions, around the world. For nearly a quarter of a century, her expertise in wartime, post-war, and refugee families has been sought after by victims of conflict, as well as by therapists and crisis counselors in training. My guest this evening has a private psychotherapy practice in New York with multilingual clients. This woman, this intelligent, articulate woman, is fluent in 8 languages. I only wish. I'm trying to master 2 or 3. She's fluent in 8 languages. Her clinical teaching and interests center on culture and sexuality with a focus on couples. On behalf of Upfront and Straightforward and the Blog Talk Radio Network, give it up for my guest this evening, book author Esther Perel. Did I pronounce it right?
Yes, Esther Perel.
Esther Perel, I am so glad to have you on my show this evening. Now your book it attracts praise, but it also sparks a little controversy here and there, reading different reviews. Let me ask you, what series of events or circumstances in your life made you aspire to become a sex therapist?
Well, I actually generally relate to myself as a couples therapist, but with a focus on sexuality, which, interestingly enough, began pretty much around the time of the Clinton scandal, the Monica Lewinsky and President Clinton at the time. So it seems that the politicization of affairs in this country has kept my interest going for quite a few years now. And at the time, one of the things I was intrigued by as a foreign therapist practicing in the U.S. was that this is a country that often seems to be quite tolerant for divorce and multiple marriages, but seems quite intolerant vis-a-vis infidelity. And the rest of the world, certainly the world that is more collective and more family-oriented actually, seems to be more willing to compromise on infidelity and is less tolerant of divorce. So I was intrigued why it is that this difference exists, and I began to look at what are some of the issues that the couples that I work with present to me, because they would present often actually happy couples, who would come in saying, we love each other very much, we have no sex. And so I was asking, why does hot sex so often fade for couples who continue to love each other as much as ever? Why doesn't good intimacy guarantee hot sex, contrary to what we often are led to believe? And then I would ask, you know, can we want what we already have? Or why does sex make babies and babies spell erotic disaster in couples? And why is it, if he goes to Argentina, if you want, why is the forbidden so erotic? And those questions became the organizing questions of my book. And it may have sparked some controversy, but actually quite little, and then got translated into 24 languages. So I think that trying to tackle the dilemmas of desire in modern couples today seemed to be a very worthwhile topic, and a topic that seems to interest people all over the world.
I agree with that. Now, well, first of all, let me ask you, where were you born and raised?
I was born in Belgium, in the Flemish part of Belgium.
Oh, okay.
So my mother language is actually Flemish.
Oh, okay, okay.
Despite the accent you're probably going to hear.
Now, I'm certain you've been well-traveled. And I've been teasing my own country the last few weeks on my show. Because when I lived in L.A., I had a lot of friends from Europe, and they always said that they perceived Americans as prudish. I don't think there's a lot of people, though, in this country that are genuinely prudish. I think they're disingenuous prudes. Do you think Americans are full of, this society is full of a number of disingenuous prudes and sexual hypocrites?
I don't know if I would put it like that. I would say that, you know, there are some unique features to the way America deals with sexuality and with the politicization of sex in its relationship to sex education for children and for teenagers, in the fact that it is one of the few Western countries that does not have a public health policy on adolescent sexuality, and it sees sex as the risk factor rather than being irresponsible as being the risk factor and sex being a normal part of development. In its relationship to gays and gay marriages, in its Puritan tradition that is often anti-hedonistic and sees pleasure from a suspicious angle. There are a number of features here. Americans don't cheat any less than the so-called French, but they just feel often more guilty about it. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is why there is each time a shock when one of the public officials seems to be straying, or is straying, actually. I don't know that I would say they're hypocrites. I think there is a kind of an anxiety around sexuality that is often prevalent in this country, and a segregation of boys and girls that happens very early on. But I don't think we need to idealize, you know, one place and vilify another. I think each country has its own challenges, you know, and there are plenty of traditional societies where there is still a lot to be done, certainly about who owns the sexuality of children and particularly who owns the sexuality of women. This is still one of the more egalitarian places.
Mm-hmm. So you don't feel like there's any... Wait, repeat that again, what you said about the United States. We tend to be more guilty about...
Yeah, Americans don't cheat less than others. They feel more guilty about it. Because they look at the subject of infidelity in terms of a moral condemnation. They don't look at it as an interpersonal issue or as, you know, whatever things may be going on inside a person. It is seen that, you know, if you lie to your wife, you must be lying to the nation. If you are, you know, cheating or if you are dishonest in one place, by definition, you're going to be honest in every other part of your life. It's seen as kind of a determining factor of your personality. But that's around the subject of infidelity, which is not the same as talking about the topic of sex per se. What's Americans' relationship to sex? There's lots of America, for one. I don't think you can answer this as a blanket statement. But in general, this is, you know, a country that has spent millions in abstinence campaigns and still seems to have 8 times more teen pregnancy than all of the EU and another 30 developing countries combined. It has onset of sexual activity 2 years earlier than the most liberal Dutch, and yet it keeps talking about abstinence. It has an anxiety around sex. I think that's what often Europeans will talk about when they see American attitude towards sexuality. There's a discomfort with it. There's a sense of sex is dirty, but keep it for the one you love.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of infidelity...
How's that for a start? I can go on, but...
Oh, go on.
No, keep going.
No, I was going to say, from your consultations, do Do you find that many men and women know ahead of time, like before they even get married, that they're going to cheat on their spouse, or is infidelity usually something that just happens?
No, I think that there's a range of things. You know, some people from the start do not see themselves as monogamous, or as monogamous in the sense of sexually exclusive, because that's one definition of monogamy. And if they could say it out loud freely to their partner, they may actually come out and say that. But if they have a partner who says, if I ever catch you, you're dead, then you learn that this is probably something that's not going to be negotiable out loud. Gay couples are more likely to negotiate boundaries, sexual boundaries in a relationship out loud. Heterosexual couples tend to negotiate it privately with themselves, and they'll decide, when does the cheating start? Am I cheating because I'm fantasizing about someone else when I'm with my partner? And am I cheating because I'm flirting with people on the subway? Am I cheating because I have just kissed but I didn't really have penetration? I mean, where's the line at which I decide this is where sex starts? And people tend to do this pretty much with themselves when it's not part of the conversation, meaning that many couples assume exclusivity, but they don't really actually bring it out. So then when it happens, it often can create quite a disaster in the relationship, because on top of it, people seem to often think that they know their partner and they kind of know him like the inside of their pocket. They take for granted the person that's been with them for a long time. And when they suddenly are faced with the reality of an infidelity, I can't imagine. I never thought my partner was capable of this. And it's like, who are you living with? Or another way of seeing it is that there seemed to be a kind of a privilege that the betrayal of the sexual infidelity stands above all other betrayals. As if, you know, when people betray each other by being mean, by being disrespectful, by being contemptuous, by neglecting, by ignoring, by not living up to the relational contract that they had, that those betrayals don't even compete with the one and only that seems to be bigger than the others. So there's a context. You know, when people become unfaithful, sometimes it has something to do with the relationship they're in, and sometimes it has actually nothing to do with their relationship. It has to do with the difficulties of what it's like to live in modern couples today who want from one person what once an entire village used to provide. You know, we want the same things that we've always wanted from marriage. I want you as a companion, and I want a family with you, and I want economic support, and we want social respectability. And on top of it today, we also want our partner to be our best friend and our trusted confidant and our passionate lover to boot, and we live twice as long as we used to. That's a tall order for one relationship to meet all these needs. Sometimes people go outside, not because they're looking for another partner necessarily, but because they're looking for another self. They've become deadened inside. They've disconnected from major parts of who they were, and they're yearning. Infidelity is sometimes as much, if not more so, about yearning and about loss, and it implies a betrayal of another person, but it's rarely the goal to go and betray someone.
Now that is very good wisdom and feedback, Ms. Perel. I'm going to take my first intermission break. And callers, if you have a question or comment for my guest, when I come back, I will get to your questions. But right now, I'm going to take an intermission break and let my guest get a swig of water. But when I come back, we'll continue this conversation, and I'll begin to take some calls, so don't go anywhere.
I want to be interviewed on Alan Roger Curry's new show.
I heard he's going to be really, really naughty on this show.
Ladies, behave yourselves. We're supposed to be, you know, good girls.
I am a good girl when I'm at church, when I'm around my parents. We are good girls. We make every effort to keep our minds out of the gutter. We don't watch porn or read erotica. We are good girls.
How's it going, ladies?
Hey, Alan.
My new show, The Erotic Conversationalist, is for everyone. Prudish, the free-spirited, and
everyone in between, for even the good girls.
Sounds interesting. You're so delicious, naughty.
No one.
I can't wait to listen.
All right, I'm going to go with my next caller. Area code 310. 310. You are now up front and straightforward with Alan Roger Curry. What's your question or comment?
I used to date lots of women, both in high school and in college and in medical school, and people used to always ask me, you're not the best looking guy, you're not the richest guy out there, how are you getting all these women? And essentially, the answer is actually quite simple. It's essentially having the confidence and knowing what you want to do.
Oh, thank you, Master Allen.
Ooh, say that again.
Yes, Master Allen.
Ooh, say that again.
Yes, sir, Master Allen.
I like that.
Hey, buddy, thank you so much for having me. That is easily the nicest introduction that I've ever had.
Single, lonely, confused, join me. I invite you to listen to the most informative and entertaining talk radio show on the internet for single men and single women looking to enhance their social lives, love lives, and or sex lives. Get on the phone right now and tell one or two of your single friends to listen to Upfront and Straightforward with yours truly, Alan Roger Curry, Thursday evenings at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Central, and 7 p.m. on the West Coast, right here on the Blog Talk Radio, Internet Radio Network. We now return to my interview with book author and sex therapist Esther Perel on Upfront and Straightforward with Alan Roger Curry, right here on the Blog Talk Radio, Internet Radio Network.
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in to tonight's episode of Upfront and Straightforward with Alan Roger Curry, I'm chatting with a world-renowned sex therapist and book author by the name of Esther Perel, and she has a book by the title of Mating in Captivity, Unlocking Erotic Intelligence. And Ms. Perel, I'm going to go, before I get back to my own questions, I'm going to go right to the phone lines. I got a couple calls in the phone queue. Area code 214, you're now up front and straightforward with Alan Roger Curry and my guest book author, Esther Perel. What's your question or comment?
Hey, what's going on? First off, Mr. Curry, I got to say, man, I appreciate what you're doing. It's a great show.
Thank you, sir.
I love the theme to the guests. I have a lovely accent, you know, that immediately grabbed me, so I had to call in. But I'm an author. I actually have a few books out, and I've dabbled in the erotic genre. And what I found in doing a lot of research for the book is that a lot of times people I interview say that they cheat or that they step out in a relationship, not so much because of their desire alone, but because they feel that their partner is no longer willing, even sometimes to the extremity that they have said, hey, you know, this is something that I'm not comfortable with, I probably won't ever be comfortable with doing or seeing or tasting or, you know, so I want to find out what her thoughts are on that topic. You know, what do you do when your partner is no longer willing to maybe cross those lines or they never will be and they declare that?
When your partner is no longer interested in being sexual with you?
Well, I wouldn't say just sexual, but let's just say everybody like a different flavor of ice cream, if you know what I mean. You know, maybe they don't like giving you chocolate anymore. Maybe, you know, maybe it's some things that they, you know, no longer find interest or they never liked, you know, whether it was oral sex or just doing it, you know, in different places. And a lot of the people I spoke to in interviews said that they stepped out in relationships because they felt that their partner was no longer willing to do those things. And sometimes they even confirmed it. So they felt like they were stuck and that their only option to get this type of quenching and satisfaction was to go find it elsewhere or leave.
I think that that's sometimes a story. But the question is, you know, how good was the fit from the start? You know, there are couples who start out hot, and then things fizzle out over time, and they don't know how to maintain an erotic spark between them. But there are just also a lot of couples who actually never really started with a good erotic connection. That wasn't necessarily what brought them together. That wasn't necessarily what they were looking for at a particular moment in their life. They wanted stability. They wanted a family life. They wanted a partner that was going to be reliable and dependable and wasn't going to leave them. And they may have had plenty of passion before, and now they want some calm. So those couples, it's not that they just come and they say, my partner is no longer willing. They basically are saying, there was a time when this didn't seem as important, or I thought it would get better, but it didn't, or I have felt lonely in this part of my life, or sex means a lot to me and it doesn't to my partner. And then, you know, comes a negotiation. When people are open and flexible with each other, they'll be willing to try certain things for the other up to a point. And then sometimes they'll say, no, I'm not up for that. And then basically sometimes you say, okay, there's a lot of other wonderful things I have here. I may not get all my little proclivities and all my little sexual preferences met. That in itself doesn't justify nor legitimize a person choosing to go and taste it elsewhere. I think that the problem is that in many couples, not much of this gets talked about. You know, sex gets talked about everywhere, usually except between intimate partners. That's where you find a lot of erotic silence, actually. And so then people live with a whole host of assumptions. Because one time somebody said, I'm not up for this, the other person takes a conclusion, that's not what they're into, and they never will want to do this, and then they draw their own conclusions, and a lot of misunderstandings get created this way. So there's a bunch of stuff, I think, that goes in there than just, I had to go elsewhere because my partner isn't into XYZ.
Mm-hmm. Very well. I mean, that's an amazing response. I mean, but now we live in an age where people are more honest, though, nowadays, than, say, 30, 40 years ago. You know, people can go out up front and say, hey, you know, this is the thing that I would like, you know, in terms of intimacy. And we do have women and men that are honest, and they will tell you, hey, you know, this is something that, you know, I do not have a desire to do. I mean, it's not uncommon.
True.
And I think that it's more selfishness now, because the thing is, when you say you want to commit to someone like that, this isn't some jump off or some, you know, fly by night, one night stand. We're talking about people who are in committed relationships. And I just personally think it's rather selfish not to be open minded and to say that, because you limit the relationship and where it can go. Because, you know, now it's okay, wow, you know, they don't want to do this. Next time it's going to be they don't want to pay the mortgage or they don't feel like they need to work. I'm very passionate about that. I think that, you know, selfishness hurts the relationship, but I really appreciate that response. That gives some insight. Hopefully there's some future books and things I'm doing.
You know, the big discussion today, I think, that is different from what once was, is that there is a sense that individual happiness and personal fulfillment and sexual satisfaction are a given in a relationship. And people want commitment, but they're not wanting necessarily commitment at the cost of having to give up certain things sometimes. And that has become much more difficult, because there was a time, and there are plenty of places in the world still today, where people don't live with the idea that they should have what they want. Actually, that's really a very Western idea. It comes with individualism, and then you link to that this idea that we should be happy. And, you know, the idea that if I'm not happy, I should go find the things that make me happy. So, yes, we live in a much more selfish time. And we also experience when our partner says no as a selfishness on their part. We don't, you know, we see them as, why should it be your way and not my way? And we can easily, you know, escalate into all kinds of power struggles about this.
You're right.
And so people accept it a lot more negative.
Well, man, again, I appreciate it. I mean, you have a lovely speaking voice. I'm sure that that gets you in the door and starts many evenings up, if you know what I mean.
All right. Thanks for calling in, brother. I appreciate your questions. I'm going to move on, actually, right to another call. Area code 301. I believe I know who this is. The man, the myth, the legend, Jason, a.k.a. 6ix9ine. What's your question or comment for my guest, book author Esther Perel?
How you doing, Alan, man?
Oh, I'm doing real good, brother. How you doing?
All right, man. Thank you. I appreciate you letting me in. Estella, I am a fan already. So I want to preface what I'm about to say with that. You know, I'm loving what you're saying, and I'm really feeling what you're saying. My question, comment, it's twofold. In looking at sexual relations in the U.S. and the way our culture views eroticism, sex, I have come to the conclusion that, just like you said in your last statements, that a lot of people have become a lot more selfish and a lot less giving. We're getting to the point where communication is shutting down. As soon as someone gets a negative answer, you know, the communication stops and everybody starts going to the next level. So now my question is, how do you combat that in a relationship where you say, baby, you know, I want to please you. Tell me, you know, how I'm going to make that happen for you. Or, honey, you know, I want to know what your fantasy is. And you don't get a full answer because a lot of people are very reticent about opening up and letting that kind of inner inhibition go. So how do you combat that in relationships going forward?
Look, I think you bring up a very important point. You know, I'm not sure that when it comes to one's real erotic truth, people are easily able to articulate it. Sex, it's very interesting, right? Most of us grow up having to keep our sexuality silent. You have to hide your fantasies. You have to hide your masturbation. You have to often live in families where sex never gets talked about or only hinted at or sometimes just joked about, or it is violated and abused and hurtful. So it's kind of difficult sometimes to want adults to feel open to talk about a topic that they spent a lifetime learning to be quiet about. That's the first thing. And then their quietness has often also been linked to feelings of guilt and feelings of shame and embarrassment. And that also isn't then easy to talk about because you fear that you're going to be judged or ridiculed or that you're going to trigger disgust in others. So people are actually very silent. If they don't talk much about what they do, they talk even less about what they're thinking about while they're doing it. And the way you work with this as a therapist is that you slowly allow people to feel safe, to bring up that part of themselves, to feel comfortable about it, to speak whatever truth they are comfortable. I don't think everything needs to be said. And to give them the permission also actually sometimes to say, I don't want to speak about it. Not everybody thinks that talking about sex makes for better sex, you know. And sometimes people are want to make a statement about what they would like. And some people actually are just happy to have a partner who says, I want to make you feel good. And that in itself is enough for them. They don't really need to say what it is. They just like the fact that there's someone who is paying attention to them, who's caring, who's attentive. And that in itself, for them, is where it would stop. So the basic idea is you get people out of a struggle, out of a power struggle, out of a confrontation, out of a system where it's an attack and a defense, and you make people comfortable to talk about this openly, naturally, without giggle and without all kinds of huffs and puffs.
Makes sense. Makes sense. So to take this to the next level, if, you know, I am feeling that I'm unfulfilled sexually.
Mm-hmm.
And I approach my partner and I say, baby, this is what I would like.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not received well. Is that a license to go out and find what I would like?
No, not necessarily. No. I think it's
okay.
A license to come back and say, you know, you seem to have a reaction about this. I'd like to understand
okay.
it. Is it because it scares you? Is it because it turns you off? Is it because you think it's weird? What's your reaction, first of all? Second of all, I would like you to understand why this is something that means something to me. You know, sex isn't just the behaviors around sex. I look at sex a little bit as a kind of a symbolic, artful, transposition, you know, creation of what people are looking for emotionally. I really am one of those people who will say sex is never just sex, even when it's hit-and-run sex. It always has a meaning. You know,
okay.
people are looking for something, a certain kind of experience. They're looking for a connection. They're looking for transcendence. They're looking for a place to be naughty. They're looking for a place where they can be safely aggressive. They're looking for a place where they can finally be greedy. They're looking for a place where they can ask and somebody will actually be there for them and not what it was like in the rest of their life when they always were told, you don't need this. Why should you want any of that to begin with? They're looking for a lot of different feelings. They're looking for a place where they can surrender control. They're looking for a place where they can be in control. They're looking for an experience where they can abdicate responsibility and have somebody else take them by the hand. And other people want to actually feel like they can finally be in charge without having to worry about hurting everybody that's around them. There's a host of emotional experiences that people look for through particular sexual acts. And when it gets translated, it takes on a whole other meaning. And then, I mean, we are miles away from going elsewhere, you know. Sometimes people come back, they try something else, they try a small piece of the thing that they would like. They ask the other person, you're willing to try this with me? If it doesn't go for you, you let me know, we'll take it from there. We're together in this.
So if I, you know, say to my partner at the time, you know, I would really like you to listen to Estelle and I want you to mimic her accent because that really turns me on. That shouldn't be a problem, right?
For whom?
For the woman that I'm with.
It depends. You know, she may be playful with you and she may put on even a thicker French accent than me and then you'll find this actually...
Uh-oh.
You know, and she may say, get off my back. What the hell are you talking about? You know? I'm not interested.
Well, no, you know, I think you have a beautiful speaking voice. So, you know, that was my...
If you want an accent, go to a French restaurant for the evening. Come back later.
There you go. That's an idea, you know, or buy
but it needs
the
humor, you know?
French.
It needs some humor. It needs the ability to say to the other person, look, these are quirks. These are idiosyncrasies. These are my own fantasies.
Let's try something new.
You know.
Right. No, I appreciate that. And, of course, to me, if you can't laugh at yourself and laugh at your situation and, you know, enjoy the process, even, you know, a lot of people take sex very seriously, but to me it's supposed to be a playful and enjoyable experience all around. You know, if you can't take it with a chuckle and a laugh, then, you know, it's not quite there.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, this is meant to be pleasurable, fun, playful, imaginative, filled with mystery and curiosity. I mean, you know, what is erotic? Erotic is this notion of pleasure for its own sake. Erotic is when people feel a sense of aliveness, of vibrancy, of vitality. People can have sex and feel none of that. You know, women have done sex for centuries and felt nothing. Sex
is... Oh, now you want to talk about women feeling
no,
sex,
because they're
doing sex.
No, I mean,
men do the same thing.
What I'm saying is that the act itself, you can go through and feel shit.
Well, now that you brought that up, Esther, you probably just defined it, but, you know, I was watching HBO's Real Sex, and they did a number of interviews where they were asking women to distinguish being erotic from being sexual.
Mm-hmm.
So what would be your clear-cut distinction between erotic behavior and sexual behavior?
All right. Animals have sex. We are the only ones who are doted with an erotic life. We can make sex in our head for 4 hours, have a fabulous time, and touch nobody. In the erotic experience, sex, the act itself, is sometimes part of it, but isn't necessary for it. The central agent of the erotic act is our imagination. So eroticism is sexuality transformed by our imagination. It's multiple, it's variable, it varies by geography, by climate, by country, by culture, by time in history. And even in our solitary pleasure, it's always plural. There's always somebody else, even if it's only in your head. And the erotic experience is the cultivation of pleasure for its own sake. Sex always can have the notion of reproduction attached to it, not in eroticism. And I think when the couples I work with complain about the listlessness of their sex lives, they sometimes want more sex, more frequent sex, but they always want better sex. And the better that they're talking about is this desire to reconnect with the quality of aliveness and vitality and playfulness and renewal and connection that sex used to afford them. That is the erotic, that sense of aliveness. And I think that when you ask why do people so often cheat, I would say that one of the main reasons why people will go elsewhere is not because there's a sexual act that their partner doesn't want to have with them, but it's usually because they want to flee a sense of deadness. It feels numb and flat in there, and they're wondering, is this it? Is this how I'm going to continue to live like that for how long? And they sometimes have deadened themselves. It's nobody else's fault. But the erotic is the antidote to death. It's that aliveness.
Wow, okay. Well, thank you, 6ix9ine, for calling in once again. That's 3 weeks in a row for 6ix9ine. I'm going to give a few other shout-outs in the chat room. We got Arnasia in the chat room. We got BS Me Mucho in the chat room. I got PPC1 in the chat room. I'm going to take another intermission break, but when I get back, I'll have some more questions for my guest, sex therapist and book author Esther Perel. Don't go anywhere. I will be right back after this.
Sound off now.
Do you enjoy great music? Do you want to sound off on the issue? Can you handle the truth through real talk, uncensored? If so, join me for the Sound Off Now Show. The Sound Off Now Show airs weekly on Tuesday nights at 10 p.m. Eastern on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Real life, real talk, real issues. Again, that's every Tuesday night, 10 p.m. Eastern at www.blogtalkradio.com/sound-off-now. Thanks, and I'll see you there. Hold up, hold up. I almost forgot about Friday nights. Hey, what's good, family? This your man, S-O-N, again. Look, after a hectic week of work and blog talk radio shows, meet me on Fridays at 12 midnight Eastern Standard Time for one of the hottest online parties on the World Wide Web. That's right, Club S-O-N, featuring one of the wildest chat rooms on the net. Check out your man, S-O-N, as I mix new and old school hip-hop, R&B, neo-soul, house, go-go, live from the Blog Talk Radio switchboard while you enjoy all of your favorite BTR personalities in the chat room. Again, that's Club S-O-N, Friday, 12 midnight Eastern Standard Time. I will see you there.
Ladies, mode one.
Mode one.
Oh, Alan, you have such an innocent, wholesome face. Who would have known you're as nasty and freaky as you are?
I'm a good girl.
My new show, The Erotic Conversationalist, is for everyone, the prudish, the free-spirited, and everyone in between. For even the good girls.
Yes, Alan, you bet. You're so deliciously naughty. Mode one. I can't wait to listen.
Single, lonely, confused, join me. I invite you to listen to the most informative and entertaining talk radio show on the internet for single men and single women looking to enhance their social lives, love lives, and or sex lives. Get on the phone right now and tell one or two of your single friends to listen to Upfront and Straightforward with yours truly, Alan Roger Curry, Thursday evenings at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Central, and 7 p.m. on the West Coast, right here on the Blog Talk Radio Internet Radio Network. Interview with book author and sex therapist Esther Perel on Upfront and Straightforward with Alan Roger Curry right here on the Blog Talk Radio Internet Radio Network. Welcome back. Welcome back to Upfront and Straightforward with Alan Roger Curry. I'm conversing with a woman who's known internationally for giving advice and consultation to many couples. She's a sex therapist as well as a well-respected book author. The name of her book is Mating in Captivity, Unlocking Erotic Intelligence. And her name is Esther Perel. And Ms. Perel, I wanted to ask you, you have a comment where you say, love needs closeness and security, but erotic desire requires distance. What do you mean by that?
Drawn to your partner. I've taken that question now to about 20 different countries in the last 2 years. And typically, I'll get answers. There's only one, by the way, that is gender-based, where women will say about the man when I see him playing with the kids, but men will never say that about the women because that's not particularly sexy. Everything else is when I see him doing something where he's in his element, when I see him on stage, when she makes me laugh, when I'm at a party and I see others looking at her, or when I'm at a party and I see him talking to others and engaging them, when I feel free, when I have had time to be on my horse and I have just been on my own, in my own space, when I see my partner in his own space, when we're away from home, when we're dancing. It's always experiences where you look at the other person from a safe distance and you look at that person as a separate entity. And in this space between me and the other is this erotic movement. It's never when we are 5 centimeters away from each other gazing into each other's eyes, and neither are any of these descriptions involving caretaking. Because caretaking is very loving, but it's unerotic. People will associate desire with wanting, not with need. When you need me, I can be loving to you, but that doesn't turn me on. And so love wants closeness. Love doesn't want threats. Love wants to minimize the distance, close the gap, but desire needs space to thrive. It needs a sense of otherness on the other side and someone to go towards. People will all the time talk about how basically, the formula would be, Alan, fire needs air. And maybe many couples don't allow each other enough air in order for the flame to stay alive. That's the difference. Love and desire, they relate, but they also conflict. And herein lies the mystery of eroticism. They're not one and the same. People can be very loving to partners for whom they have no desire. And people can have desire for people they don't love. But when you want to bring the two together, it's about managing back and forth how you want closeness in order to feel secure in love and how you need space in order to be adventurous in sex.
Now, see, I'm a generalize here, but based on what you just said, I feel like men have an easier time separating the two than the average woman does. Like, speaking for myself and a lot of men I know, there are a lot of women in my life that I've had a strong sexual, erotic desire for, but I was nowhere close to feeling like I was in love with them or any type of profound emotions. And conversely, there are some women that I only interacted with a few weeks that I felt myself, as corny as it may sound, kind of falling in love with them, but I didn't have that strong erotic passion towards these particular women. So do you think some of that is a gender thing, or it doesn't matter what gender you are, is the validity of what you say?
I think that there are a lot of gender differences, big ones, starting with anatomy, but I also know from my work with same-sex couples that sometimes it's more roles than gender per se. I think that the idea often is that women want security and that men are more likely to be roamers. And, you know, if women were so domesticated and wanted love in order to be able to be sexual, then why would every civilization throughout history spend so much energy controlling female sexuality if she isn't going to go anywhere anyway? Where we know,
that's a valid point.
If she's that sweet and tame, then why has every culture put so much pressure on keeping women staying put? And we know that in societies that are more egalitarian and where women have more economic independence and are less vulnerable and not threatened with the death penalty if they're caught cheating, the rates of infidelity between men and women, the gap is closing every day in major ways. So I'm not sure that by definition you can say, you know, men can keep sex and love separately. I think that men have been given the permission to do so, and men have often been encouraged, if not forced, to actually sometimes make it look like what they wanted was sex, because it wasn't as manly to talk about their desire for love. And for women, historically, it's probably reversed. Women were allowed to love, but if they talked too much about how much they liked sex, they would be called sluts. And so they had to find loving relationships in order to feel okay to express their sexuality. But I'm not sure that it's intrinsic to people as much as the way that societies and cultures are socializing us from the day we come out.
Okay.
You know, if a woman goes and says too blatantly that she likes sex, it's usually not looked upon with a very good eye. So she has to hide her sexuality within, you know, wrappings of relationship. And when you ask about infidelity, men typically will overrepresent and they will boast about it, and women will typically underrepresent because they will hide it. Because for a man to be very sexual, it's considered more manly. And for a woman to be very sexual and blatantly so, it's considered to be a certain kind of woman and not particularly the good one.
Okay. Now, do you think now living in the 21st century, do you think women have gained more freedom to express themselves in a more naughty, erotically uninhibited manner, or you still think it's kind of going from decade to decade, everything you said is to be true?
Oh, I think there is a lot more freedom. I think that definitely the first freedom that women got was the pill, contraception. Any form of contraception really freed women from the dangers of sex, from the dangers of pregnancy and the dangers of mortality. So that was probably the most important change in terms of women being able to experience sex for pleasure without having to be afraid of it. From that moment on comes the shift from sex being a female marital duty, and sex is something she does for him and gives to him, to sex is something that she can claim, and we're switching from duty to pleasure. She too is allowed to enjoy pleasure. She too is allowed to hope that her partner would care about it, and she finds many more men today who are interested in her enjoying it and caring about it. I think the changes go on both sides. Not just she's changing, so is he. In order for her to feel more at ease, to be desiring and to be open about her wants, she needs to feel that there's someone on the other side who cares about it and isn't just there to take his own pleasure and then be done with it. But still, I think that women often will still put themselves in the position of being desired rather than in desiring, and in making herself desirable rather than in claiming her own wanting. And that is changing as you go in younger generations, but I don't think it's changing nearly as much as we sometimes think it does from looking at the culture out loud, at large. When you go inside relationships, you kind of get a sense that certain historical things are rooted quite deep inside of us. So you get, you know, a woman that looks 21st century the way you talk about, and she's a professional and she's independent and she earns her own money and the whole thing. But then when it comes to sex, She's got the church in her head. She's got her family history in her head. She's got, you know, everything about literature in her head and what good girls do and good girls don't do. And she finds herself quite challenged. She's not nearly as liberated as she would appear to be because of how she is in other parts of her life.
Mm-hmm. Now, how important do you think it is for each partner in a relationship to maintain their own unique sexual fantasies, but then discuss some of them with each other?
Look, I think it's two questions, Alan. I think that our fantasy life, our erotic imagination is central. If we didn't have erotic imagination, we would probably not be able to remain sexual for that long. This is the first time in history that couples are supposed to have sex not because they want 12 kids and not because it's a woman's duty, just because they feel like it. Desire is at the core of sexuality today in couple life. And in general, I mean, you do it because it's something that makes you feel good and you feel like it and you like it and you enjoy it and all of that. So erotic imagination is essential to that. If you can't imagine yourself pretty or young when you're not so young anymore, or desirable or ravenous or ravished or any of those things, then it's very hard to remain active. I mean, that makes you, it connects you to your own erotic self. Sharing fantasies is a different story. Some people really get off on it. It's a real intimate moment for them to actually reveal the inner chambers of their erotic mind. And it breeds spark between them. For other people, telling it is actually not what it's there for. They really actually enjoy it in their own mind, and they don't necessarily even want to live it out. You know, their fantasies, you just want to be able to imagine, and you don't want to experience it really, and then they're the ones that you want to experience. And then they're the one that you want to experience with your partner knowing it. And then they're the ones that you want to experience and nobody else would actually know what goes on in your head while this is all happening. So there's a range of them. I think the pressure sometimes is to say couples need to share their fantasies. No. Some do, some don't. Some people like it, some people want it. And some are very happy to have a whole world in their head up there that is a complete free space where they can go and nobody knows where they are. And they love it. You know, I think where it becomes complicated is if one person really wants to experience their fantasies and the other one is completely turned off by it. Mm-hmm. Then the question is, do you keep going with it inside of your own head? Is that enough for you? Or do you start to be frustrated all the time because there are certain places that you would like to go and you don't have a partner to go there with you? But I think the general answer for me is there's no dogma. What works for one couple doesn't work for another. And by the way, what works for you with one partner isn't going to be the same as what you will want with another partner. We don't have one sexuality. We have many sexualities, and they change in the course of our life and with the persons that we are with. We're not static. There may be one person with whom you just never wanted to talk about your inner life. And then there's another one with whom this has been the greatest thing that you've discovered, is talking about your inner fantasies. And then there's another third one with which you really loved hearing theirs and you were more than happy to be a participant in their own fantasy, but you had a sense that they would never really get what it is that you're going for and what gets you going, and you just decided that this isn't going to be the person that I'm going to share this part of myself with. It's a different piece each time.
Okay. Now, how does the idea of power and control play into a relationship sex life?
Oh, big time. I mean, first, I don't think there's a single relationship that doesn't have a power dynamic. And that in and of itself. The minute you love someone, you depend upon them. And when you depend upon someone, they have power. Power that you give them also. But they have power. So I look at power not as a negative word. I think it's intrinsic to love and it's intrinsic to dependency, which is part of love. In sex, I think that when you ask people about their fantasies, especially, you know, if you go back to your question about women and how they, you know, don't seem to be able to separate, many fantasies of women are fantasies that imply stories or images or scripts or relationships that involve a dynamic of power. He ravishes me. He keeps coming after me. and the more he comes after me, and the more I resist, and the more it makes me know how much he wants only me, and I become irresistible, and his pushing is met by my yielding, and it is a complete turn-on. It's never power that is meant to be hurtful. Nobody wants to be really hurt. People have fantasies of power that have to do with having a good time. Let's be very clear, because no one wants to be pinned down or controlled if they're controlled in their real life. You can only fantasize about something that isn't happening to you for real. Hmm. Because fantasy is play. That's really, really essential for people to understand. And people like the sexual experience as a place where they can sometimes abdicate control. And that abdicating control, I give myself over to you because you will, and it's a real expression of trust and a sense that you will know to make me have a good time. You will bring me to pleasure by my giving myself into your hands, or the reverse. I now can be a totally sweet man my whole day, and I'm a caring, giving dad, and I'm a good friend, and I'm a good son, and I'm a good citizen. And then there is this place where I go, and I can be safely aggressive, and I can actually bring out parts of myself that don't get expressed in other parts of my life. So, yes, people want to experience the power of themselves and the power of the other, which, when it becomes eroticized, becomes highly pleasurable. And that doesn't mean hitting and spanking. And sometimes it's just blindfolding. Sometimes it's just you hold my hands down. It can be very gentle, you know. But there's always an element that implies not just a little stroke like you stroke a baby. Mm-hmm. Not always, but in those fantasies that you're talking about.
Okay.
And I, by the way, the more egalitarian the society becomes, the more equal people sometimes experience themselves with their partner, the more likely it is that their fantasy life implies exchanges of power. Mm. I take charge, you take charge. I take the lead, you take the lead. I initiate, you initiate. These are all power dances. They're soft, but they're all power dances.
I got another call. Area code 253. I know who this is. This is one of my ace buddies, Irvin V. Pulliam III, fellow Gary, Indiana native, who I'm sure is sad about Michael Jackson passing. But in regards to tonight's show, what is your question or comment for my guest, Ms. Esther Perel?
Actually, I do. I have a question for Esther. If I'm understanding, if I was understanding before correctly, if Esther said that that you need this form of distance in order to express yourself in an erotic way, if I was understanding that correctly, I was wondering that how is that possible? If in a lot of cases, I know females feel like they have to have a certain amount of intimacy to be in that state of mind, and if you have to have a form of distance, I mean, I think I was just a little confused about how that is even possible. If Esther could speak to that.
But ask your partner.
That would be great.
Right. See, I would say ask those partners what they mean by intimate. What does it mean that we are intimate now? That, you know, you're focused on me, that I know that it is me that you are interested in, that you desire me, that you care about my thoughts, my feelings, my well-being. What is intimate at that moment? What makes them feel connected? And then the next question. Hello?
Yeah.
And then the next question is, you ask them, what turns you on? What turns you on? And see if they are one and the same. The question I often will ask you is, if you ask people, you know, when you think of love, or when you are loved, or when you love, how do you feel? And you'll get a whole range of words that have to do with intimate. When I'm accepted, when I feel valued, soft, tender, warm. But then when you ask them, what comes to mind when you think about sex, or when you are desiring, or when you are wanted, you're going to get words like hot and hungry and urge and excited, and they are not the same words in both categories. So my invitation is ask your partner what it is that they want, and then ask them what it is that turns them on, and you'll get a better sense as to where they want you to be vis-a-vis them.
Okay. Did that answer your question sufficiently, EVP?
Oh, yeah. Yes, it did. Yes, it did. Definitely.
All right. Thank you for calling in. That's EVP3, like family. I wanted to ask you, what are your thoughts about polyamorous dating, like swinging, couple swapping, that sort of thing?
Well, swinging and polyamory, the people who are polyamorous would probably think that those are two very different things, you know, because they have a very clear idea about what it's like to have multiple partners and to be committed to multiple partners. And so polyamory, I think, exists on its own terms. And then swinging, you know, it's a form of consensual adultery, basically. It's a way for people often to go into broaden their repertoire, to enhance their erotic connection. It's something that they are wanting to do together to bring some sexual energy into their relationship. It's a way of having more than what they can have just alone, but within certain boundaries. And I think basically it needs to be negotiated with people so that both of them really feel like this is something they'd like to try, or that both of them actually are into it and they enjoy it, that nobody is forced to go, because otherwise they feel like their partner would leave them if they don't feel like joining them or things like that. And for many people, for a while, and sometimes it's on a regular basis, sometimes it's periodical, that they feel like we're going to go play, we're going to go meet other people, we're going to go and experience together something that we are also experiencing separately. And then they negotiate, right? You can be with me. You have to be in the same room. I have to be able to see you. No, I don't want to see you. You can be with me, women, as well. No, I don't want you to be with same-sex partners. I mean, there's a whole range of conversation that people often have about what are the rules of the game. Every game has rules, and once the people follow the rules, they can have a very good time playing. You know, it's one more form of, you know, participating together in an erotic scheme, in sexual games. I really look at it like that, meant to make people feel that this part of their life that they value, that they say is important to them, and they say, let's expand, you know, let's experience more. And that more may invite for us more partners. So some people invite more partners just in fantasy. They never really meet an actual third person. And some people actually want to invite the third as a real person in between them. And really, Alan, if people agree on things, if they have a kind of a groove about this and they say, you know, I'm intrigued, I want to try, or we've tried, we like it, you know, people go and they do it. It's consensual and it's fun. The problem is more often when one person is really into it and the other one feels, oh, you want to go see others because you're bored with me, or because you don't like me, or because you're no longer attracted to me and I can't keep your interest. And obviously you want to go elsewhere is a statement about what you don't have with me. Then you're in a whole different storyline.
Now, I was going to ask you, reading the reviews of your book, there was one thing that seemed to spark a lot of controversy among your readers, and I couldn't find a specific section in your book, but you essentially, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, you basically say it's okay for a partner in a relationship to hide a sexual tryst, a one-night stand, weekend fling, that sort of thing. You believe it's better kept to themselves than sharing it with your partner?
I don't think I ever actually said any of that. But I did say in my book is that there is a kind of a preference these days that everything needs to be shared and everything needs to be told, and that honesty, as in confession, is really the only way to go. And I think that's sometimes it's the case, but I think in other situations there isn't much to gain. With that kind of honesty, no. I think that sometimes protection is also important, not just confession. And I think sometimes people you know, America in this sense has a very clear idea that honesty is the most important value of a relationship. In many other cultures, honesty is one value among many. It's not the only one. And sometimes lying is seen as a form of protection and not just as a hypocrisy and as a deceit. It's
well,
different.
See, now this is interesting because if you were familiar with my book, I have a book called Mode One, Let the Women Know What You're Really Thinking. And my whole book is all about I'm telling men to be upfront and straightforward.
I know. I saw it.
Oh, you thought? Okay. But matter of fact, since you're familiar with my book, I always ask my guests on my show to do this little lighthearted favor for me. The name of my book has become a chant on the show. So instead of just saying mode one, you stretch out the O's and you go, mode one. So I want to hear you say it in that really sexy voice of yours. Mode one.
Mode one.
Mode one. Alan Roger Curry.
Mode one. Up front, straightforward.
Mode one. Alan Roger Curry.
Area code 313-313. Do you have a question or comment for my guest tonight, Mr. Stair Perel?
You know what's crazy? I do.
Okay.
Question that I have is, how is it that a couple in a relationship can expect to stay in love as strong as they are after going through a menage a trois?
Why not? Why not? I mean, sometimes they actually are even more loving. I mean, sometimes it has nothing to do with how much they love each other or not. It's just something that they wanted to experience. It depends. Are we talking about a one-night experience with a third person? Are we talking about a whole life structure that implies a threesome? I mean, I think, you know, what is a menage a trois? It's a one-night experience? Which one are we talking about here?
I mean, if the couple has been together for a long time, you know, a couple of years, and, you know, and they actually go through, and, you know, a man and a woman, they pull in the extra woman, you know, for a night of pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my thing, you know, is on the whole infidelity aspect and showing that both the people in the relationship have a certain greed factor. You know, because I don't understand how a menage a trois is not considered cheating, but, you know, if a male goes and he finds another woman outside the relationship just for those purposes, that is considered cheating. So I don't see how the love can still be as strong, you know, when it comes to intimacy after dealing with something like that.
Look, infidelity is a violation of trust. It's a breach of an agreement that two people had made. If two people together decide that they want to have an experiment, there is no infidelity. That is the real difference. Infidelity is not what is the person doing on the outside. You could be doing nothing but having coffee with another person when the couple had decided no coffees with other people. So the violation of trust is the essential piece of the infidelity. Okay? Every couple has boundaries. And every couple lives in the shadow of the betrayal of these boundaries, no matter how open a couple you are, for that matter. But if two people want to experience something together and they invite in a third, we're not in the infidelity zone. And they may afterwards just say, ah, that was boring. That's not for us. We tried it and didn't do anything. Or they may say, that was a lot of fun. Not sure we want to do it again. Or they may say, it was a lot of fun. Let's try again. Or they may actually say, this was a wonderful thing we experienced together and it makes us feel even closer because we got to see things about each other that we never knew existed. It's a broad range of this, but I don't think that in and of itself it says anything about people loving each other less because they wanted to have sexual experimentation together. It's together. They agree on it. It's something they feel like doing. They're going to play. And really, I'm going to bring back the word, this is about sexual play together. It's very different from one person going on their own against an agreement between two people and having their having their other encounters. And there I come back to Alan. Do all these encounters need to be shared? I'm not always sure that it's the best thing. What's to be gained sometimes, you know? Maybe sometimes protecting the relationship is more important than just, you know, having wholesale sharing and dishing everything out. And I'm not sure it's which one each time, but I think it is worthwhile not to just see confession as the one and only right way to go about, with, you know, about some of these things. Afterwards, sometimes it can take years for people to trust again, to heal again. And there are lots of things people do that they don't share with their partner. Lots. Even when they hide at night eating from the closet. You know.
Listen, I've really enjoyed having you on the show tonight. You've provided some great, great, great feedback and words of wisdom. And I think I'm going to have you on again sometime in the fall so you can share more. Please tell my listeners where they can find you on the World Wide Web.
www.estherperel.com. The name of the book is Mating in Captivity, Unlocking Erotic Intelligence. And on the website, you'll pretty much get other talks of mine, as well as every info about the book and in every language you care to.
Do you do workshops in different cities or not?
Yes, I do. I train therapists, and I also do workshops for couples retreats. And so if people want to join my mailing list, they just write through the website. If they want to be informed about different workshops, I do them all over the country, yeah.
Okay. All righty then. Well, again, thank you for joining me. And when I come back after this intermission, we will switch gears and begin to talk about, I'm going to invite listeners to call in, to discuss the passing of music legend Michael Jackson right after this intermission break.
Listeners, did you miss last week's episode of Upfront and Straightforward with Alan Roger Curry? Well, here's what you missed.
Eric, code 301, you're upfront and straightforward with Alan Roger Curry and Ms. Timmons. You got a question or comment?
Miss Timmons, Alan, how you doing at 6'9"?
Hi.
Hey, what's up, 6'9"?
6'9"!
How you doing?
I hope you're working on a routine with that name.
yes I am, but, you know, the name actually comes from my height. A lot of women seem to think it has something, a sexual connotation to it, but that's an entirely different show, and I'm going to try to stay on topic this week.
Remember, if you missed Alan's show live, you can always download his past episodes from either iTunes.com or the blogtalkradio.com website. Mode 1! If there is one man I know whose voice always gets me hot and bothered, it's Alan Roger Curry, otherwise known as the King of Verbal Seduction. Ladies, are you ready to open up about your past sexual experiences? Your most kinky fantasies? Your innermost erotic desires? Then get ready for Alan's new show, appropriately entitled The Erotic Conversationalist. This show will be entertaining, educating, and of course, arousing. Please tell all of your friends. And oh ladies, when you tune into Alan's new show, please don't forget your vibrator.
is Esther Perel on Upfront and Straightforward with Alan Roger Curry, right here on the Blog Talk Radio, Internet Radio Network. Actually, that audio is wrong. We will not be returning to the interview with Esther Perel. Actually, the Esther Perel interview was only scheduled to 11:30 p.m. Eastern time, but I'm extending the show to talk about the death of a legend. He's a hometown boy for me. I'm born and raised in Gary, Indiana, and the Jackson family was raised in Gary, Indiana. And, what can you say? You know, this was an unexpected death, I think, for most fans of Michael Jackson. I would have expected Michael to live to, 70s, 80s. He was always a guy who was, from what I know about him, he emphasized a healthy lifestyle. I think for most of his life, he was actually a vegetarian. He was a vegetarian. So, his presence is going to be missed tremendously. And as I started out saying at the outset of the show, Michael Jackson, to talk about the impact he had on myself, is that he was the first person in my young life that I saw become successful. Most people that I knew of, when say I was in elementary, junior high, they either were unsuccessful or they were already successful. I didn't really see too many people climb the ladder. And Michael and the Jackson 5, they were the first group of people that I saw go from like local Gary, Indiana legends to national legends, and then eventually worldwide legends. I used to get excited whenever they dropped an album. And me and my brother, we would jump up like it was Christmas every time a new Jackson album was released. We get on the phone, talk to different people, friends, cousins, whatever. When I was in high school, me and my brother used to have some of their steps mastered. Some of our friends at the party would applaud us, others would laugh at us. But we had the steps down, man. We had them steps down. And his presence is going to be missed. I can't say that I ever met Michael Jackson in person, even though we both were born in Gary. I can't say I even crossed paths with him other than, of course, being at his concerts. But I have met his siblings. I've met I met Randy, Tito, and Marlon and Jackie when they came to Gary to promote their album, 2300 Jackson Street. And then my brother and I had an extensive conversation with Jackie, the eldest brother. And Jackie was really appreciative of everything we told. We told him how excited we were to listen to Michael Jackson and the Jackson 5 when we were little. And we told him how we would always turn on Soul Train. And, Jackie was good people. Jackie, past tense, he's still alive. But Jackie, we talked to him, my brother and I. This was in Westwood, California. We talked for probably over an hour just about his career, their career. And he was really down to earth. Jackie is very down to earth, very down to earth brother. And but Michael, my best friend lives in Indianapolis, and he has a young son. And just when his young son was starting to walk, they said he would not dance to anybody's music. When any other music came on the radio, he would not get up and respond at all. But whenever Michael Jackson music came on the radio, they put it on CD, his son would get up and start dancing. What does that say to you?
Now, this kid, he's not old enough to discern whose music it is. It's not like he's consciously selecting Michael Jackson's music. But that's the only music that he would get up and dance to. Talk to me. Talk to me. What is that about? What is that about? I got a caller. Area code 602-602. You're up front of Straightforward Alan Roger Curry. What's your first name and what's your comment about Michael Jackson's passing?
Alan, what's up, man? It's Gary Lynch.
what's up,
homie?
Gary Lynch, man? Gary
what's
Lynch,
going on?
Another Gary, Indiana native. Hey, brother, good to hear from you, man.
Thanks, brother. First of all,
man, what was your first reaction when you heard the news today?
Shock. Shock, man. Complete shock. I mean, the only other thing I can think of that took me as far down was Marvin Gaye passing away. Because those are people that I can relate to, and you know they're you know relatively things that you know that I know. It's truly a hard thing, you know. Michael transcended everything that most people know. That's the outpouring of love that you're seeing right now on all the stations. He truly was an icon, but he was from where we're from. You know, and I identify with that. You know, it's a very, very, very strong thing we got about being from Gary, man. And you know that, Al.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know that. You know, I remember being in the parties when we all trying to dance like Mike. You and Steve trying to do the thing. I remember those days, huh? You know I remember those days. You know I remember those days, man. So, I mean... He is a part of my childhood, and I'm amazed at all the people now that are just like, we love Michael Jackson and we love him for the person that he is. So I like that about it, man. You know, You know.
Yeah, man.
So
what's killing me, man, is that you know, us from Gary, we look at him not only as an entertainer, but kind of as family.
As family, exactly.
And
exactly.
But, you know, I'll be honest, man, I've had some different emotions going on today. And one of them, unfortunately, has been anger because I've been listening to people on TV want to talk about all the negative stuff.
Right, exactly.
Scandals and stuff. Number one, the brother was acquitted, man, of all charges. All charges. Not half, not a third. He was acquitted of all charges. And I think anybody who's intellectually savvy knows, I don't want to get on my soapbox, so excuse me, Gary, but...
No, go ahead, bro.
That was somebody trying to extort money from this brother.
Right.
I mean, you don't just develop in midlife an affinity for molesting kids. I've done research on that. That's something that's long-standing.
That's long-term,
that don't just
yeah, right.
In your mid-30s or 40s. So anyway, I don't even want to get into the next bit, but, you know, I didn't like hearing these people on TV going towards
you know,
that.
But if we're going to talk about it, let's talk about the humanitarian thing he's done, about how much money he's given away and how he gave up himself. All right? Michael was truly a citizen of the world. You know? He's a brother from Gary, Indiana. Born and raised, right? He was born there, born in Methodist Hospital, right there. But that man, he's a man of the world. He's a citizen of the world. And the world has fully lost one of his great people, man. Truly. Truly. And, you know, hey, everybody hug your kids tonight and let them know. Let them know who he was. Let them know. Brother, hey, much love, man. Keep
hey,
it going,
man.
All right?
Hey, brother, man, really appreciate you calling in.
Got to, brother. You holding it down for the G, man. You holding it down. All right.
Thank you, Gary. Thank
all
you.
All right, man.
All right, bro.
Much love.
Much love to you,
all
too.
Right. Later.
That's Gary Lynch. Known him since high school. Go way back. He's from Gary, Indiana. You know, we socialize at many parties together. But you know, some of these people on TV talking about all these, you know, acting like he was convicted of something. Michael Jackson, again, I don't even want to go there with the negative stuff, because like I said at the beginning of the show, I've defended Mike to the death. Until somebody showed me some evidence that would prove contrary, you know, hey, you never, ever, ever convince me that this brother was guilty of anything other than giving the world great talent. I got area code 312. 312, you're up front and straightforward with Alan Roger Curry. We're discussing the passing of music legend Michael Jackson. What's your question or comment? 312? Hello?
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 Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Oh, you know, I hit the button by mistake. I listened to the show.
This is JP!
This is Mike Bennett.
What's up, Mike Bennett? Mike Bennett, good friend. Matter of fact, Mike Bennett is the one who was responsible for my guest last week, Derrick Timmons. So Mike knows everybody. He knows people not only in every state in the country. He knows people in Dubai, Japan, China. The only place he don't know anybody is North Korea, because he don't mess around with North Korea. But Mike,
I don't mess around with people that clearly don't like us.
What are your thoughts? What did you think when you first heard the news that Michael Jackson passed away?
Down in Facebook. Michael Jackson was a philanthropist, humanitarian for the world, entrepreneur, mission artist. But he was somebody's father. I think he was a warrior of peace. And a great entertainer. Also a great entrepreneur and businessman, and I think ultimately all kind of stress that normal person.
Wait, hey Mike, hold on a second, your voice is fading in and out. Gotta try to get you back. Hold on 1 second, listeners. I think my friend Mike's voice faded out. No, hold on. Mike, you there?
Hello?
Hello? Okay, there you go. Got you back.
Sorry about that. I was just saying, I saw Michael Jackson, the philanthropist, citizen of the world, an entrepreneur, artist, a father, a son, a brother, a warrior of peace, and a good person. And that's ultimately, him being such a business-minded, focused artist in this country ultimately gave him all kind of stress that most humans wouldn't.
Exactly.
Artist.
Uh-oh. Lost Mike again. Lost Mike. Hopefully we can get him back. But yeah, one of the things Mike brought up is that this guy's business savvy. If you read biographical information on Michael Jackson, this guy, when he was like 10, 11, 12 years old, he had the business sense. Many people say who interacted with him, they say he had the business sense of someone who was 35 years old. That's how this guy was not only a musical prodigy, but he was a business prodigy. He was a business prodigy. And he actually used to negotiate some of their contracts when he was a teenager. So, you know, this guy was heavy. He was heavy, not only on stage or in the recording studio, but he was heavy in the business room. That's the legacy of Michael Jackson. Michael Jackson never wanted to be a trend follower. He always wanted to be a trendsetter. And I invite any caller who has some comments that they want to say. I'm going to be on the air for roughly the next 40 minutes talking about Michael Jackson. The number is 646-478-5710, 646-478-5710. I'm going to see if I can bring mic bag. I think he might be on a cell phone, and the voice is going in and out. But let's see if I Mike, you there again?
Hello.
There you go. You're back.
Yeah, I'm in agreement. I think he was clearly a businessman, and that's something that ultimately I thought brought more stress to him than the average human, particularly American human business person. And you know, clearly he was a musician that was loved and an artist, but he was clearly a philanthropist and a humanitarian and a citizen of the world. And his business savvy, I think in the future would be looked at in terms of other artists creating their career and growing their creative, whatever process they have. They're going to look at Michael Jackson as a case study, whether it be Harvard or whether it be, you know, at some musical school, of his talents of being able to sing. But he clearly was a businessman. And but to that end, I think that brought more stress to him than most.
Yeah, I would agree.
Owning Sony, owning parts of Sony, owning real estate in Los Angeles and in California, owning other things around the world, and then being a bringing issues around being a humanitarian is always going to bring stress, particularly to a black man. But I was just kind of leave it at that.
Exactly. Good feedback, Mike. Good feedback. Listeners, this is my buddy Mike Bennett, who is very media and entertainment savvy, and I think his comment is going to ring true about Michael Jackson will end up being a case study in the future. And he wasn't, I guess you would say, he wasn't really formally educated. He didn't have a college degree, but by all accounts, anybody who interacted with him said he had an insatiable desire to read books, and he was just a very intelligent man. And he was the one, really, Mike, who you would have to agree, he kind of revolutionized the video age. I mean, he took videos to a whole nother level.
Yeah, he took video to another level. He incorporated special effects into video that were unheard of at the time, and really, really was cutting edge when it came to technology. He was always in the front of it and using it in his process of creation.
Yes. Well, thanks, Mike, for calling in. I appreciate you contributing your thoughts about Michael Jackson this evening. And again, I thank you for providing me with my guest last week. Continued success to you, and you have a great weekend. That was Mike Bennett, folks. Mike Bennett, good friend of mine, who's again one of the most well-traveled gentlemen I know. I wish I'd been the one third of the place this man has been. But anybody else who wants to call in is 646-478-5710. I see one of these Internet numbers. I got to see what this is about. But in the meantime, I'm getting ready to play another Michael Jackson song. I'll be right back after I play. Wait, which one do I want to play? I got to see which one I want to play. I got so many. Okay, we'll go with Butterflies.
Walk away and pass me by. must be dreaming, can't be real. You're not here with me. See, but I can feel you're near to me. I caress you, let you taste the just so blissful. Listen, I would kiss you in a sleeping. Yet to make my dream come true, I'll save you. Give me butterflies.
Spending about the last third of my show discussing the passing of Michael Jackson. If you were here earlier, you know I had an interview with a sex therapist and book author by the name of Esther Perel. That was a very, very informative interview. She really provided us with some great answers, great feedback. Only thing that I would challenge on is the honesty thing, because anybody who knows about my book, Mode 1 and Upfront and Straightforward, knows I'm all about upfront, straightforward honesty. But that aside, I thought Esther Perel was just excellent. But on the line right now, I got a young lady who's also from Michael Jackson's hometown of Gary, Indiana. Now, listeners, I got to warn you, this young lady has one of the most infectious laughs of anybody I've ever been acquainted with. Her name is Shay. Shay, thank you for calling in. What are your thoughts? Well, first of all, what was your reaction when you first heard the news that Michael Jackson passed away?
Oh, I was stunned. I still am. You know, it's like, as we know, the whole life of fame, or different famous people, oftentimes you hear rumors here and there over the years that so-and-so has died or so-and-so was in a car accident and they died. And you hear the media retract those stories, you know, and unfortunately this wasn't one that was retracted.
Right. See, matter of fact, I was getting kind of frustrated on Facebook because they said he was dead. Then some people said, no, don't believe TMZ. I don't know. That was an emotional roller coaster for me. But yeah, I just, man, that really threw me for a loop, man. I'm not gonna even lie, Shay. I was crying like a baby when I first heard that.
Yeah, it's awful. I mean, you wanted, at least for me, I wanted to hang on until it was declared by some kind of representative of the family or the hospital, you know, just to confirm it. But, you know, as you alluded to, me being from Gary originally, Gary kind of was synonymous with Michael Jackson. You know, I don't know, when you first went off to school, anytime you meet somebody and you tell them you're from Gary, the first thing they come out of their mouth is, "You been to 2300 Jackson seat?" You know, you know Michael Jackson.
Yeah, matter of fact, I went by there today and paid my respects. They had all, shoot, by the time I got there, all the little news crews, them news crews must travel quick, man.
Oh, yeah.
Because they had the trucks out there. But, I mean, it's amazing, really, though. When you look at 2300 Jackson Street, it boggles the mind to know that 9 kids grew up in that house.
Very humbling.
But they made it. They took it to the highest level, you know, first as a family, and then Michael, you know, even took it to a higher level as a solo artist. And but yeah, it did, you know, being a native of Gary, I think it gave us all a source of pride to know that he was, you know, raised in front of us. And, you know, like I remember, I was telling my listeners earlier, I remember seeing him at Westside High School, you know, perform. You know, when they was just on that level, they performed. I remember his father, man, he came on stage looking mean. And he said, "You want to hear my sons perform?" And everybody went, "Yeah." He said, "Then shut up."
That is too much.
I was like, "Man, Joe Jackson ain't no joke, man."
But you know what? I guess to his defense, and I don't, you know, I'm not a part of that family, my bloodline or anything. But you know, a lot of people had strict fathers.
True.
I mean, we really don't know exactly what went on in their household, but you know.
Yeah, but I mean, he just, to me, his music was always cutting edge, and it was not, it was very rarely trendy, you know, he had his own sound, his own mannerism as an entertainer, and I think anybody who went to a Michael Jackson concert, I would dare anybody to say they weren't entertained at a Michael Jackson concert. Because that man puts. How many Jackson concerts did you go to, Shay?
I've only been to one.
One? Were you blown away by that one?
That was actually the family tour in 84, I think, or 85 or 86, something like that. I can't remember. But when they went together as a family,
okay.
It was like mid 80s.
Okay.
I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, man. Almost every concert I've been to multiple times. Anyway, what, I'm gonna ask you before I let you go. What's your? He has so many hits that I think it would be hard for any fan to narrow it down to one. But if you had to name one, I'll even let you extend it to maybe your top two to three. What would be those Michael Jackson songs that's gonna stay with you forever?
I'd have to say Thriller, number one, because when you think about Thriller and what it did for the video age, and how today, where you have wedding parties performing Thriller at receptions, I mean, I've never seen anybody, you know, come out the wedding party at a reception and do something off of anybody else but Thriller. You know, I mean, that's phenomenal to incorporate something that he did so many years ago into that special day. But I still have to say the Off the Wall album probably was one of the most slept on.
True. Off the Wall, man. You know, Thriller gets all the attention, but Off the Wall, man, was really a... That was phenomenal. That's when I think many people who weren't fans of his before really took notice to him and said, okay, this guy is for real. Cause, I mean, the thing about Michael Jackson's albums, such as Off the Wall and Thriller, is that prior to him, a lot of songs, I would just listen to my favorite two or three songs on the album. I wouldn't even listen to the rest of the album.
Mm-hmm.
But pretty much all the Jackson 5 albums, and even more specifically his albums, I would listen to every single song. Every single song. I mean, it's very rarely where it was just a sorry song on his album. So, yeah, he will be truly, truly missed. But anyway, Shay, see, I wish I had about a slew of jokes so I could get you to laugh.
You know, Alan, there's one other thing I would like to say is it's really unfortunate with the discussions of his low years. And, you know, I'm glad you took the opportunity to talk about the good about Michael Jackson when so many media outlets right now are just narrowing his life to a few years that he was really down. And that's really unfortunate considering he has a family and so many other famous people have left us in the last couple of years who've had things in their lives that were unpleasant. And they kind of swept those under the rug for sake of the family or their kids. But they're not doing that for Mike. And that's really unfortunate.
Very, very. I'm glad you said that, Shay. I'm so glad you said that. Yes, it was. I'll be honest, before I went on air tonight, I was watching some of these TV channels getting pissed. Because some of them, they spend like two-thirds, three-fourths of the time talking about the negative stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, talking about a trial where he got acquitted of all charges.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was charged with 16 counts, and he got acquitted of all of them. But yet, they were talking about him like he was some kind of convict or something. Yeah, that,
yep.
Man, that was getting my blood boiling.
Yeah, it's sad. It's sad. It really is. You know, even when you think about commercials, like when he did the big Pepsi commercial, I mean, you have entertainers going to that length for advertisement.
Exactly.
He was larger than life. He will truly be missed.
Very much so. Very much so. Well, again, thank you for calling in, Shay.
Oh, no problem.
Stay cool in this hot weather. And G.I. to the death.
G.I.? All
right. There's a laugh.
Stop it.
Listeners, that's my friend Shay from the G.I. She now lives over in Chicago, as many former G.I. do. If anybody else wants to call in, I'm going to be online for another roughly 15 to 20 minutes. So if you want to call in, 646-478-5710, 646-478-5710. I see my younger cuz in the chat room is requesting that I play. I don't have that, cuz. Man, I got to see if I can get that. I want you back. I don't have that in my collection, but I will work on trying to get it. Yeah, man, that's a classic jam when he was still with the Jackson 5. I want you back. Don't even get me to start trying to sing. Shoot, y'all stop listening to my show if you hear me trying to sing. But Michael Jackson, you know, what can you say? He's just a major talent that I'm going to miss. I'm going to miss him like I don't know what. I mean, all from the time I was young, everybody who knew me know that was my number one man. I mean, that brother inspired me. I would say a good part of the reason why I personally became interested in pursuing a career in the entertainment industry, even though I never pursued any career as a singer or musician. But one of the reasons why I did want to pursue a career in the entertainment industry was because of the influence of Michael Jackson and the Jackson 5. Because, like I said a number of times already, the Jackson 5 is what showed me that you could actually make it. You know, because I joked about it at the beginning of the show, but it was so true. When I was little, I didn't look at celebrities as real people. I really didn't. I looked at celebrities almost like they were their own race of people. And the Jackson 5 was what really, you know, that was the first product I saw just make it, you know, kind of, you know, I'm not going to say the exact starting point, but I think when I became familiar with them, they had already started, but they were not the national sensations that they became later on. And, yeah, it was, you know. So, yeah, he had a big influence on me. You know, I used to listen to his music all the time. When I was in college, I used to be the master of ceremonies for this traveling ensemble they had called the IU Soul Review. And I used to always mimic. Like, one year I was doing it around the time Thriller had come out, and I was mimicking his moves on stage, and, you know, the crowd was going crazy. And I did the moonwalk. It took me a long time to master that. But I can say here with full conviction, and I dare another IU alumnus to challenge me, I was the best moonwalker on the campus of Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana. I was the best, that's right, I was the best moonwalk. I could moonwalk my butt off, and because I studied him doing that at the anniversary show. Well, you know, a lot of people say that Motown anniversary show is what catapulted him to the next level. That's what catapulted him to the next level, was that his performance on the Motown, I think it's 25th anniversary show, Motown 25th anniversary. So that was the show. Now somebody done called me out in my chat room. Yes, I knew this was going to happen. See, I can't talk about Michael Jackson without kind of dating myself because, you know, there's a lot of women, quite frankly, on Facebook. They think I'm still in my, like, early to mid-30s. And but no, I'm not going to say my exact age, but let's just say I'm older than my early to mid-30s. And, I was born in the 60s. And I was very familiar with the rise of Jackson 5 and the rise of Michael Jackson as an entertainer. And, to me, he just made so much music that was just classic. His music, I guarantee you, is going to stand the test of time. I guarantee you it's going to stand the test of time. I'll be right back after these couple songs.
sweet love till the break of dawn.
I don't want the sun to shine. I wanna be in love.
Break of dawn.
There's magic in your eyes and in my heart.
Break of dawn.
I don't know what I'm gonna do.
I don't
have a love in
it's
you.
Break of dawn.
I won't stop till break of dawn. Being in love.
Oh, my hands feel the sweat. But you got me nervous.
Michael Jackson and the passing of a musical legend. I only got a few more minutes, so if you want to call in with a quick comment, I'm willing to take it. 646-478-5710, 646-478-5710 is the number. Yeah, Michael Jackson. What they doing closing my chat room? Oh my goodness, they closed my chat. Man, that's blasphemous. That is blasphemous. How you going to close my chat room? I got beef now with Blog Talk Radio. They closed my chat room. But yeah, Michael Jackson was born in 1958. Passed away today at the age of... wait a minute.
No, I'm sorry.
He was born. Yeah.
Born in 58.
Yeah, because his birthday is coming up in August, so he would have been 51 in August. So yeah, he was 50 years old. 50 years old. Michael Jackson. Man. If there was ever a legend in the music industry, I know people say Elvis is a legend, and, you know, different people, the Beatles, people say a legend. But, you know, there's many black legends. You got Marvin Gaye and the Temptations. But Michael Jackson, man, he's going to go down in history. Yes, indeed. Michael Jackson. Yeah, that really messed with my emotions earlier today. And, you know, I was able to calm down before my show. But, man, that hit me like a ton of bricks. And I was just tripping off the news that Farrah Fawcett had passed away. And all of a sudden, I started hearing things about Michael Jackson. Man. Yeah, like I said, man, nobody gives a concert like Mike. Nobody gives a concert like Mike. Mike, that dude, unbelievable concert. So yeah, well, they closed my chat room. So if somebody wants to call in, and somehow you're listening to my show, 646-478-5710, 646-478-5710. I'm going to actually wrap up in about 3-4 minutes. So I just want to thank everyone for really coming to my show tonight. I had a good crowd out here, both in the chat room. I'm sure I had 9 chat room listeners. When they always give props to my most loyal listeners, like my cousins, Christopher Curry, Jason P. Jones, my good friend Irvin V. Pulliam III, even though his younger brother wasn't around tonight, his younger brother Philip Pulliam, like fam, Mike Bennett, you heard from him tonight. Shay, good friend, called in tonight. I'd like to thank 6ix9ine for calling in. Adrian, who was in the chat room. Hyperd, Rael Sims, Angel Eyes, Sound Off. Oh, I can just name so many names of people who I appreciate, who support my show, come here pretty much every week and show me love and show my guests love, and that is much appreciated on behalf of yours truly. Next week I will have a very interesting show. A woman by the name of Dr. Yvonne K. Fulbright will be here to talk about women's orgasmic hotspots. Women's orgasmic hotspots. She'll be talking about sex toys, masturbation. How can you go wrong with that show? So until next week, be safe, have an enjoyable weekend, and I will see you next Thursday at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Central, 7 p.m. on the West Coast. Take care.